Slate spoiler specials are brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/spoiler.
Hi, I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and this is a Slate spoiler special podcast on The Avengers, the new Joss Whedon-directed, super tentpole marvelous, what do we even call it, the movie of the summer.
It's a culmination of 5 years of tentpole franchises into a super franchise.
Exactly. This is like some new word besides blockbuster has to be invented to encapsulate what this movie is. So joining me in the Slate studio is Chris Wade. Hi, Chris.
Hello, podcast listeners.
And you are an associate producer at Slate V, the video arm of Slate.
Yes,
and
I am.
Also very frequently the producer of these podcasts. So you're actually stepping into the other side of the glass.
It's nice to be from behind the audio board.
Yeah, you're taping yourself. You're like, this is a total Chris Wade production.
I am almost the auteur of this podcast.
Yes, especially because you are going to end up talking a lot more than me in this one, because I had you in because you are enough of a comics nerd and enough of a Marvel fan to actually be able to talk me through some of the mythology of this movie.
Although I do want to make clear, should there be any sticklers out in the audience, that I have read much more about Marvel than I have actually read Marvel comics.
But were you, as a kid, somebody who would go and get the new comics every week when they came out?
Yeah, I was always into comics, and I was an infrequent reader. Whenever, you know, I saw them around, I would pick up something based on the cover. So I always had like a small collection, but I never really entered deeply enough into the world or had a guide or, you know, I feel like maybe like an older brother who was really into it. I was just always like, oh, this is cool. I'll get something. It was cool. So I've always been fascinated with comic fandom and I guess fandoms in general, which is probably why I'm also a big Joss Whedon fan.
Yes, and that was another reason I wanted to have you in on this, is that I'm not a Buffy person. I'm somewhat familiar with Joss Whedon's movie work, but not really his TV stuff. And so maybe you can also sort of show me what he's doing with this franchise that's new. Because I have to say, and we usually start these off with some sort of evaluative comment before we get to spoiling, that I was a little disappointed in this movie. I had fun. It was plenty of fun seeing it last night, and it sort of disappeared right after you see it, as these movies are meant to do. But I don't feel like Joss Whedon was really turning anything inside out the way that I had hoped that he might. And there probably is a limited amount of freedom that he has to do that with a monster production like this that has to set global records to make its money back.
Yeah, I think that my initial reaction is pretty similar to that. You know, I wouldn't call it disappointed. I think the movie's awesome. It's really, can we say badass in this podcast? It's really badass. It's fun. It's funny. But also, as you mentioned, this is kind of like a perfect storm for me and I think a lot of fans who are, you know, the confluence of comic book people and Buffy people is like a large overlap. That middle Venn diagram is very large. So I think that a lot of people are really excited for this. And it's not revolutionary. I think he helmed it as a technician more than a sincere, like, Joss Whedon, this is a Whedon craft.
How would that have been different? I mean, if it imagined it.
I feel like this was like the Whedon sheen applied to another DNA,
mm-hmm.
whereas something like Cabin in the Woods, which we're going to discuss later, I believe, is more of like the Whedon DNA with another type of movie grafted on top of it. So you see his flourishes here, but the basic story has already been told by five other directors, you know, ranging from a weird collection of directors from Jon Favreau on Iron Man,
right,
to Kenneth Branagh directing Thor.
That's right, he directed Thor, and Joe Johnston was the guy who directed the Captain America movie.
Yeah, so. And all these people are like directors who would imagine to have like, you know, kind of their own personal craft. But all these movies look so similar. They look of the same world, which they're meant to, because, you know, Marvel's trying to do this whole building a movie Marvelverse.
Right. And so I think that was the hardest thing, that the task that this movie had on its plate was sort of, this is not only has to entertain people for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. It's pretty long. I mean, if this kind of movie has to be long to give you your money's worth, right? As we were saying before the movie started last night, even if it's bad, at least there's going to be a lot of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how did you feel that it did it at combining those universes? I mean, they're pretty different aesthetics, right?
Yeah. And the question of how much this has been like a top-down, like, I feel like there was some very good management at Marvel Studios. They've like the ability to like keep all these threads going as independent franchises that come out, you know, years apart from each other, but still aesthetic, helmed by different people, you know, different casts, you know, a few crossovers like Phil Coulson. Or is it Agent Coulson, I believe?
Yeah, Clark Gregg plays him. That's a great role. The colorless.
He's been in a lot of them.
The loyal agent.
Yeah. That all feel, you know, everybody from Jon Favreau to Kenneth Branagh, you would not imagine, like, are very much in the same filmic circle, you know, helming movies that feel very similar to each other. So I guess it's not – and it's not often that I'd say this, but kudos to Marvel as a movie studio for, like, having a singular vision that it's, you know, creating as a very lucrative business plan, obviously, but something that all these movies feel very much of the same universe.
Yeah, I guess to me it seems more like kudos for the marketing, which is a little bit different than, you know, kudos for what you created. But let's talk about what does work and what is fun in this movie. And let's actually get to some very specific spoilage, because we just talked about this in the Slate Culture Gabfest and we felt like, oh, we have to stick to kind of the big ideas and themes. We don't want to give anything away. And in a movie like this, I mean, you're pretty sure that the good guys are going to win. That's not really what it's all about. But the stuff I want to spoil is like, what makes the movie worthwhile? What are the things that stick with you?
Great. Well, let's do some just like basic plot first, just so we have a bed
to rest on. Okay.
So having seen all the movies leading into this, I would say that the immediate prequel to this, despite being the second to last one that came out, was Thor. The events of this movie pick up pretty much right after the end of Thor. We see Loki, a demigod of chaos from the mythical realm of Asgard, which is this realm of Norse gods that exists within the Marvel Universe. Having in his exile, in which he was banished from Asgard by Thor for trying to steal the power of the Tesseract, and source of limitless energy from the mythical Asgard realm,
which is basically like a glowing cube, about slightly larger than a Rubik's cube. Mm-hmm. It's totally the MacGuffin of this movie.
Yeah.
I don't remember the word Tesseract being really big in Thor, but yeah, Tesseract I think is the first possibly word said in this movie, right?
Yeah.
First thing you see is the revolving cube, and then the Tesseract has awakened or something.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That. All I can think when I hear the word Tesseract is the Madeleine L'Engle book, A Wrinkle in Time. Do you remember that book?
I've never read that book, but I'm sure I would love it.
A Tesseract is very key, and I don't think it's an object in that book as much as it's sort of like a
force.
A means of transporting, you know, from one
is
place
it, is
time
the word
to
Tesseract used in that?
It's huge in that book, and it's so long ago that I read it that now people are going to have to write in and tell me exactly what it was, but I know it was the thing that enabled them to put the wrinkle in time and travel.
Right. So yes, Thor has banished Loki from Asgard. Loki, Thor's brother, half-brother, is pissed. He teams up with this race of reptilian aliens out in the deepest recesses of space to find the Tesseract and use it to bring their alien army to Earth to conquer. Everybody seems really bent on conquering Earth. We never really get the motivation of, like, why Earth, other than Loki just seems to like to screw people.
But I kind of like that lack of motivation. I like that kind of villain in these movies, right? I mean, rather than sort of the calculating $1 million kind of Austin Powers villain, I like the villain who just likes to sow kind of chaos and havoc, a little bit like the Joker in The Dark Knight, right? And that's exactly how Tom Hiddleston, who I think is really wonderful as Loki, plays the role. And one of my favorite moments with him that occurs again and again is his kind of mischievous smile when he does something horrible. You know, it's not an evil cackle. It's not big. It's almost like a boyish grin of delight that he's just fucking stuff up.
Yeah. And his, I guess his motivation, as much as he states it, is that he wants to rule something. He didn't get to rule Asgard and Thor. He wants to rule something, and humans are meant to be ruled, which is a great backbone for a story about superheroes, because you want to like have the everyman identify with the hero who emerges from you, you know?
Right, right. So he has to set himself up as this kind of anti-democratic, you know, force, as somebody who believes that all humans are actually just meant to kowtow. So then at that point, Nick Fury, who hasn't helmed any... I'm sorry, no, you just keep saying helms, I was saying. So at that point, Nick Fury, played by Samuel Jackson, who hasn't played the lead in any of these movies yet, but has sort of appeared as the Avenger gathering, almost like the manager of the Avengers, right? Mm-hmm. He begins to reach out to the world's superheroes to try to make this super force to find the stolen Tesseract.
Yeah.
And those guys are, let's enumerate them.
In reverse chronological order, we have Iron Man, Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr., who lovingly chews the scenery in every scene he's in. Next would be the Hulk.
who was Edward Norton in the last time we've seen him, now played by Mark Ruffalo, who did a great job, I felt like.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. And it's really clear that they're trying to reinvent the Hulk completely. They're essentially paying no attention to the Ang Lee Hulk or the Ed Norton Hulk, right?
Yeah.
They're just bringing about this new Bruce Banner, who Mark Ruffalo is perfect as a Bruce Banner. He has exactly that rumpled professorial kind of feel that you want. And he doesn't seem to belong in the movie, which is kind of perfect.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think we'll probably talk more about this later, but I think the Hulk ends up being one of the best parts of this film.
Oh, definitely.
And then we get Thor, the kind of haughty, you know, he is a god. He is the ruler of this realm of deities. But as he's on a mission. He was taught to love Earth by Natalie Portman in Thor.
Nobody does it better.
Yeah, of last summer. So who is in a funny throwaway line like, don't worry, Natalie Portman's been moved to a safe location, Thor. And the all-American boy who is like the embodiment of this true spirit of heroes, Captain America.
I'm very fond of Chris Evans as Captain America, and I actually liked that Captain America movie more than almost any superhero movie I've seen in the last 5 years.
Yeah, that Captain America movie is like just like a great – it feels like a very 40s like comic book story. And I mean, Nazis are always a great villain, which I think helped a lot. Actually, I think both Thor and – or Chris Evans and Chris Hemsworth do a great job of that like almost naively good characters. And I think they do that wide-eyed – we are good and only good.
Right. They're not the Dark Knight with some sort of a dark, deep flaw that they're hiding, right? They're just pure up, sunny side up good guys. So two new characters are introduced as well, at least new to the movies, which is the Black Widow, played by Scarlett Johansson, and Hawkeye. Is that what he's called, the Jeremy Renner character?
Yeah, Hawkeye.
Who gets kind of short shrift in the movie, I feel.
Yeah, Hawkeye starts the movie being mind-controlled by Loki and being a bad guy for the first half under the mind control of the Chaos God. And then halfway through, in a very convenient turn, gets punched really hard by Black Widow and loses his mind control and then joins the squad.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of a raw deal for Jeremy Renner because I think he was excited to be doing his first action movie and all he gets to do for most of the time is walk around glassy-eyed executing the will of Loki. And at the end, he gets a little bit of action with his bow and arrow, but I feel like he kind of got the worst deal of anybody.
Although there are a few solid moments of relationship between Black Widow and Hawkeye that I feel – and in the what Joss Whedon brought to this movie that I think was like the key thing is like being able to see maybe each set of characters has like 3 minutes of like solid character interaction time throughout the entire thing because there's just like so many heroes you've got to get through. But each of those 3 minutes is like so economically used to like – define who they are, define their relationships. You know, these two characters you haven't really seen that much of get like a just enough backstory to be like, oh, I get your motivations. I see how you relate to each other and everybody else on the team.
Yeah, I see an origin story for them. I could imagine somebody going back and making a prequel about the Black Widow and Hawkeye and what happened in Budapest, which they make a vague reference to.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, there's a alluded to tormented past between them that in its briefness was compelling enough to give those characters a little weight.
Chris, let me stop you for 1 second for a word from our sponsor, Audible.com. So the Slate Spoiler Special podcast is delighted to be sponsored by Audible.com. Audible offers more than 100,000 titles, fiction, nonfiction, drama, journalism, everything you can imagine, which you can play on any device, including whatever you're using to listen to us right now. And Audible has a special offer for Spoiler Special listeners. Sign up at audiblepodcast.com/spoiler, and you can get a 30-day free trial, a free audiobook, and also a free subscription to The New York Times or The Wall Street Journal as a daily audio digest. So, with that deal, you can choose one free book from their vast selection of titles. And I have one to recommend because I was so fond of Mark Ruffalo in this movie. I looked up Mark Ruffalo on Audible to see if he read any books that they have. I thought he might have read a whole audiobook. And he doesn't, but he does appear in a play on Audible that's by Kenneth Lonergan, the playwright who's something of – Mark Ruffalo has been something of a muse for him. He wrote two movies that Mark Ruffalo has appeared in, You Can Count on Me, which was sort of Mark Ruffalo's big breakthrough movie back in the 90s, and also Margaret, a movie which came out last year that Ruffalo has an important role in that I don't know if you know the story of Margaret, but it was sort of championed in this great grassroots cause by a bunch of film lovers who wanted this movie to be rescued from the obscurity that its development hell had kind of left it in. It's an interesting story, an interesting movie. I didn't love Margaret, but I do love Mark Ruffalo in it. So Lonergan, who's more known as a playwright than as a screenwriter and director, has a play called This Is Our Youth that is starring Mark Ruffalo, Missy Yeager, and Josh Hamilton. I believe they starred in the play in L.A. in its premiere, and here they're reenacting it as essentially an audio drama, which is something I've never checked out on Audible. That seems exciting. So Kenneth Lonergan's This Is Our Youth with Mark Ruffalo is one great title that you can find on Audible. And you would sign up for that by using this URL, so Audible knows you're a spoiler listener, audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. Okay, so back to the Avengers. So let's just walk through some of this elephantine story and try not to get too bogged down. But so Loki takes the Tesseract, the magic cube, and disappears with it. Nick Fury assembles the Avengers and gets them all up on this giant, massive aircraft carrier.
The most impractical base of all times, a aircraft carrier that also flies as a giant floating fortress.
Yeah, why would they wouldn't just hole up underground somewhere? I have no idea.
Yeah, an aircraft carrier that was a submarine would seem more practical. So that's the aircraft carrier. They're using Bruce Banner's knowledge of gamma radiation, which the Tesseract apparently emits, to like try to track it down. They're using facial recognition to find Loki. Loki shows up in Germany. The Captain America and Iron Man go easily subdue him and bring him in. It's a little suspicious. There's some business with Thor showing up and trying to bring Loki back into justice in Asgard. Of course, Iron Man and Thor have to fight because they want different things and they're assembling a team together, so they have to fight before they become friends.
Yeah, the first hour has quite a bit of internecine superhero struggle as they kind of try to decide, you know, the eternal schoolyard questions about who would beat who in a fight.
And it kind of all culminates with a pretty solid, if a little confusing, scene where the whole team is together for the first time in that laboratory, basically arguing about why they're here, what the motivation of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nick Fury is, what they each bring to the table. You know, this is where people get a few good jabs at Bruce Banner being like, oh, you're just an uncontrollable monster. And he's like, well, I'm only here as a scientist. And, you know, basically everybody getting each other's goat for 10 minutes before it is conveniently interrupted by the still mind-controlled Hawkeye attacking the flying aircraft carrier at Loki's bidding.
Right. And so then there's a very long and I think pretty dull set piece of essentially one of the engines falling off the aircraft carrier. And
yeah.
Iron Man has to try to fix it. And Captain America helps him. And the two of them start to bond. And this is a moment when I just sort of thought, like, this movie still has a long way to go. Mm-hmm. It's one of those kind of tentpole movies where every 20 minutes there has to be an intense CGI heavy battle sequence culminating in this really huge one that sort of evokes almost a Michael Bay sequence where essentially New York is being taken apart by these semi-organic, semi-robotic alien beings from outer space. And then it just really felt like it was a generic summer action movie at that point. And I didn't see what all the character development had been for in the first place.
Yeah. From that moment on, the movie pretty much devolves into a single extended battle sequence. Loki escapes. He disperses the team. Thor ends up trapped in a containment unit, like a super jail cell that gets ejected from the ship and lands in a field somewhere. Hulk, in a pretty hilarious moment, gets carried away on a fighter jet and just falls off into nowhere. In a Hallmark Whedon-esque moment, Phil Coulson gets stabbed by Loki, the one character you just like really like and are sympathetic with.
Why you call that a Hallmark Whedon-esque moment. I did think that it was one of the more powerful things in the movie, right? Because there's so many super bodies having super horrible things done to them, and you kind of lose the sense of the vulnerability of any individual mortal person because they sort of aren't mortal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's at least two different moments when a character really should die, even by the logic of the movie. When Thor is ejected in that super jail cell, right?
Yeah.
And it falls like 30,000 feet to Earth or something like that. And also when Robert Downey Jr. at the end, when Tony Stark as Iron Man decides, oh, I'm going to sacrifice myself. Remember, he has that rogue nuke and he's going to go and put it in the space portal, whatever. And it's this moment that we're sort of seeing like he's learned to sacrifice and he's no longer just a selfish, arrogant guy. And yet he unproblematically makes it, right? There's maybe 15 seconds when you think he might have been dead. And so to get back to Agent Coulson again, there's just so many moments of impossible survival that when this regular, ordinary, not super guy who we've gotten pretty invested with because of his, you know, his presence in all these movies is suddenly stabbed to death and dies before our eyes, it's pretty hard to take. And the superheroes really feel it too.
Yeah, and that it becomes kind of the motivating factor for the third act of like, and that's where Robert Downey Jr. really steps up and is like, we are the ones who should be sacrificing ourselves because we're the ones made to stop this.
So tell me again, so why is this a core Joss Whedon kind of scene?
Well, there are a few, as I said, there are a few Joss Whedon glosses on this that I feel like fans will recognize. Joss is known for killing off the most beloved characters in the franchises. Some might say cruelly, but often to incredible dramatic effect. I might as well spoil everything, as fans of Buffy might remember from the infamous Tara murder, which kind of was one of the most wrenching moments of the scene. And it was like, it's a character who is not one of the powered ones, who's beloved and has always been a force of good, just needlessly dying because of the conflict around them. That's like classic Whedon trope. A few other good things, like a thing that he does that I don't even know if I recognize until now, where he kind of lets like what would a writing room phrase become part of the show itself. Like an example from this from Buffy would be that the characters in this like gang of good do-gooders actually refer to themselves as the Scoobies in the show, as like the Scooby gang. Which becomes like a thing, or they actually refer to the bad guy of the season as the big bad, as opposed
right.
to separate him from like any smaller threat. And like one thing they did in this movie was the conveniently referring to the Hulk as the other guy. So instead of, I feel like most Hulk movies, there's a lot of, tiptoeing around like the monster I have inside
right.
me, or like a beast within. And that's like literally like, no, there's Bruce Banner and the other guy.
Right. Which is also – that helps us get to know Bruce Banner, because we see that that's his way of kind of avoiding – right? He doesn't want to engage with his own anger and his mm-hmm. own Hulkdom. So he creates this kind of euphemism about the other guy. I think that the Hulk, the way that it's handled, not just Ruffalo's performance and his casting, which is really smart, but the whole way that story was handled was the closest this movie came to bringing anything fresh to the superhero world. I really liked the just basically everything involving the Hulk, how he looks when he turns into the Hulk, mm-hmm. the process of transformation, but also kind of – not trying to make that conflict into this giant, bombastic sort of Christopher Nolan-esque struggle within or something, but to make it sort of comic and also maybe a little bit sexualized. It's not really direct, but there's a moment when he turns into the Hulk and he's chasing Scarlett Johansson around. It's not implied that he's chasing her to have sex with her, right?
Yeah.
He's trying to kill her, but there's something kind of sexy about the Hulk bursting out and, chasing this woman in skin-tight cat suit around an aircraft carrier.
Yeah. I also think that the Hulk was probably the most fun character in this movie, and there are a lot of great jokes at the expense of the Hulk, and a lot of great jabs at Mark Ruffalo, who's like very game to be this guy who you can't get too angry, but they all still seem to enjoy like messing with him.
Well, because there seems to be, and this is maybe what you mean about the sort of in jokes of the Joss Whedon world, but it seems to be agreed among the other superheroes that the Hulk is both lesser than and greater than them, right?
Yeah.
He can't control his alter ego unlike them, and so he's sort of unpolished, he's kind of a brute, he's kind of laughable because of his lack of control, but also ultimately that makes him the strongest, right?
Yeah.
And there's several scenes where essentially nobody, including the gods from outer space, can stand up to the Hulk when he's angry.
Yeah, exactly. Which was probably the best moment of the film. The Hulk finds Loki in Tony Stark's penthouse, where he's holding up and using the Tesseract to keep this portal open that's letting this alien army evade. And Tom Hiddleston has, like a lot of Loki speeches in the movie, this great, you are nothing but emotion and rage, and I have control, and I am the one who is born to rule, and I am a god and powerful. And then, like, mid-word, just a giant Hulk hand comes out and grabs Loki's legs and then just swings him around,
like
into
a rag
the floor,
doll, right?
Into the rag doll, and just totally wails on him for 8-10 seconds and leaves Loki in, like, a concrete divot in the ground, just staring shocked out. And the Hulk, in one of his few lines as the Hulk, which surprisingly voiced by Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah,
turns around and walks away from Loki just saying, I'm a god, going, puny god.
It's true that this Hulk barely utters any words, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't even say Hulk smash or anything. He's very, very low on language. The moment that I thought you were going to cite, which I think is the movie's best joke probably, and it's also Hulk-related, is just that there's some moment, and I can't remember quite what they're doing, but the Hulk and Thor are taking somebody out together, right? They're collaborating on some kind of a bad guy wailing. And then we see them both sort of fly and land. And it's just the moment that one of them would deliver a wisecrack. I think Thor is even sort of starting to open his mouth to deliver a wisecrack. And just with a sort of burst of pure excess rage, just because he's got some extra anger, the Hulk just reaches out and punches out Thor and he falls out of frame. And it's a really silly slapstick moment, but the audience loved it. They went completely nuts.
Yeah. And I feel a lot of people will say this, that Whedon was, you know, kind of almost so perfect. It was like an obvious choice to do this. He's great at handling, you know, multiple characters, a large group of characters, giving them equal weight, kind of being able to, like, with very brief touches, evoke, like, bits of character that allow them to play off each other, a sense of humor in their interactions while maintaining the weight of the situation around it, and a sense of humor within action scenes. It is, in the end, a not totally exceptional summer action movie, but for how much stuff is going on in it and how many movies of information it has to draw on, I feel like it clips along really nicely, and it's consistently fun and consistently well-balanced.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you're starting to make the case in a way that convinces me, and I certainly wasn't bored when I was watching it, but I don't know. It's true that he sneaks in a lot of stuff around the edges, but there still is just such a huge elephantine There is still just such a huge elephantine thing that he has to sneak around the edges of. I just think he can't get out of what this movie is. And what it ultimately is a marketing-driven, you know, just something massive that has to appeal to the most possible number of people. There's only so much cleverness that can be snuck in around the edges.
Yeah. And I think I had just like one more point that I wanted to hit, which is that I'm simultaneously compelled and turned off by the Marvel's trend of interweaving all these tentpole blockbuster movies into one Marvelverse. Because on one hand, I find it compelling that you can kind of tell a story of the evolution of an entire universe of superheroed characters across multiple movies, across multiple years, through many franchises. And one thing that happens in one movie shows up in another movie, and that characters can interact each other across these tentpole franchises. And although it's not, you know, that dynamically used yet, I think it's like an interesting thing that they have to play around with. But on the other hand, it makes a lot of these movies feel like just business to get to another movie. And that's like a kind of how I felt like Thor. It just felt like an extended prequel to this movie. And a lot of the plot of Thor was basically set up for what's going on in here. And in a weird way, this movie felt like the second and third act of a movie instead of like a full movie. It's like you already have to know so much information going into the beginning of it that it almost feels like an incomplete, you know, story.
And it's also the question, of course, of where are they going to go from here? Now, do they start going smaller again and spinning things off? I mean, I did find myself kind of craving a Black Widow, mm-hmm. Hawkeye-centered prequel. And maybe that's the direction they go, is they sort of start shooting off tendrils in all different directions. Who knows? I mean, it's pretty obvious already that's having opened overseas to huge box office that they're going to be making as many more movies out of this Marvel bunch as they can. Oh, wait, as long as we're talking about future movies, you have to tell me what was up with the ending. Even you were not enough of a comics nerd to know. So there's a post-credit or mid-credit kind of sneak preview of what's coming next. And so some sort of red, scaly, grinning dude got a big reaction from the audience. Who was he?
Yeah, so we go back to the alien race staring at a light in the distance, which we can assume is the direction of Earth or the universe that Earth is in. The alien master from this movie that was partnered with Loki basically saying, like, the humans were more resilient than we could have ever imagined. To attack Earth would be to court death. And then, yes, this huge, red, scaly, blockheaded guy kind of looks to the camera and grins like a bring-it-on grin. I did have to look this up later, and the general consensus is that character is Thanos, who is a super-powered, super-smart brawler who becomes obsessed with the idea of death and controlling death, and eventually goes on to, in one of the larger arcs of maybe a mid-80s or 90s Marvel storyline, controlling the Chaos Gauntlet, which is a glove with these powerful gems embedded in it that gives him unlimited power.
Ooh, the Chaos Gauntlet. I want to see
phrase?
The Chaos Gauntlet. Totally.
Well, that's
phrase.
The thing.
And Thanos is a great name for a death-obsessed god because it comes from Thanatos, right, for death.
And I actually believe that in Thor, in that if you remember Thor, there's like a hall of powerful objects that the – what is it? The Tesseract. The Tesseract was stored in this like hall – of powerful objects. And I believe in the background you can see the Chaos Gauntlet sitting on a shelf somewhere. So it all – see, that's what the compelling part. It all comes back together in the end.
Oh, God. Here we go again. Yeah. Thanos and the Chaos Gauntlet, summer of 2013. Okay. Well, Chris, thanks so much for coming in
Thank
and taking it all
me.
Apart with me. And please come and spoil another movie with me soon.
Okay. Great.
Our producer and guest is Chris Wade. Our executive producer is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
And just a brief postscript. I realized as I was editing this all together that it was not, in fact, the Chaos Gauntlet, but instead the Infinity Gauntlet that Thanos wielded to gain omnipotence. Small distinction, but I realize how detail-oriented comics fans can be, so I have done my due diligence. Please do not yell at me on the internet. Thanks for listening.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.